Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Today, it's great to have Gustav Kohn on the show. Born in Switzerland, Kohn discovered his passion for magic at the age of 13, and much of his teenage years were dedicated to the art of illusion and deception. At the age of 19, he moved to London to follow his dream of becoming a professional magician, but his career took a dramatic change after he discovered a keen interest for psychology. Uh-oh. Gustav went on to study psychology at Sussex University, and towards the end of his PhD, he noticed a direct link between magic and psychology. His unique background in science and magic allowed him to build bridges between these two domains, which helped him establish a science of magic. Kohn is a reader at Goldsmiths University of London and director of the Magic Lab, which stands for Mind, Attention, and General Illusory Cognition. He is one of the pioneering researchers in the science of magic, and he is one of the founding members and president of the Science of Magic Association. His latest book is called Experiencing the Impossible, The Science of Magic. Gustav, so great to talk to you today.
Hello. Hi.
You sound very excited to be on the show.
I am. Oh,
okay. Yeah. Well, thank you for being on the show. This is the first time we've represented magic. And personally, I'm very excited to have this conversation with you because I was really into magic as a child. I used to do like bar mitzvahs and things like that, along that, you know, like and children's parties and never really got invited back. But yeah.
So you did actual performances then?
Yes. I'd pull rabbits out of hats and
Oh, wow.
All sorts of things. But I was just fascinated with it. I wonder to the what extent it influenced my interest in psychology. There's a link there, right? There's something that lit you up when you discovered psychology. And what's the overlap there? What's the Venn diagram?
Yeah, well, in some ways it's a bit of a weird link because it took a lot longer than I expected it would take. Because, I mean, I don't know what you were like when you were performing magic, but I was interested in anything that could improve my performances. And I read lots of really weird books from palm reading to body language and, of course, psychology as well, because magic is really all about psychology. Magic is a process that happens inside the spectator's mind. And to create a powerful magical illusion, you really need to understand how humans think and behave. And so I read a lot of psychology or pop psychology books as a teenager. And it was really my passion for magic and that sparked my interest in psychology. So I went to study psychology at university. But I was rather disappointed because none of the psychology that I came across at university had anything to do with magic. And when I talked to people about magic, they thought it was interesting, but there just simply hadn't been any research done on this. And I then went on to do a PhD in consciousness, and it was only towards the end of my PhD that I actually properly realized this link between psychology and magic, because a lot of questions that psychologists are interested in, such as consciousness, belief, attention, free will, well, these are all principles that magicians have learned about over generations. And that was really the spark for me to establish the science of magic. And it really started by simply trying to understand how magicians can misdirect people's attention.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the perception literature, it's all about illusions.
It's a lot of it is, and there's lots of indirect links. I mean, if you think about the perception literature, but even developmental psychologists as well, because a lot of the developmental paradigms that are used are actually simple magic tricks as well. So developmental psychologists perform magic tricks for infants and young children, and they measure how they respond to them as a way of really understanding how their brain works. And rather than performing magic just for kids, we actually perform magic tricks for adults, again, as a way of understanding how human cognition works.
Wonderful. So do you still perform at all, or did you ever perform?
Yeah, I used to perform semi-professionally. My big aim was to become a professional magician. I grew up in Switzerland. I, at the age of 19, I moved to London to start my career, really, as a professional magician. I failed quite badly in that I just simply couldn't find enough work. And that's what then led me back into academia again.
Really? So it's like those who can't teach, what's the expression? Those who can't do it, teach it or something?
Yeah, well, it was maybe not quite as direct.
Don't be so hard on yourself.
Not quite as direct as that. I think it's also I realized that actually I became more interested in studying more about the human mind than just simply performing magic.
Is that cognitive dissonance?
I don't think it is. I think I came to London at the time where magic just simply wasn't actually that popular, I don't think. Magic is really popular in the UK at the moment. But at the time, it was very difficult to get paid work. I was also trained as a busker, but in London, busking was banned in most places at the time. So again, that made it very difficult to make a living.
I have two questions. One, what is busking? And two, why was it banned?
So busking. Well, busking is street performing.
Oh,
okay. A student of Cimicellini, so I was trained as a street performer. And why it was banned, I don't know. I never really fully understood this. There were only very few places in London where you're actually allowed to busk. Huh.
So let's back up a second and define the word magic, because you talk about that a little bit in your book. And I was wondering if we could put some parameters around that. Like, what's not magic?
Well, magic is one of these really tough terms to define, like consciousness or lots of other things. And I think it's a very ill-defined term and quite a poorly understood term as well. What's interesting about magic from a performance point of view is that magicians spend a lot of time writing about how you can actually create magic, but they don't spend that much time actually trying to understand what the concept itself means. So very little is really known about the concept of magic itself in a performance context. And again, here, I mean, this is where it gets a bit murky. The kind of magic that I'm interested in is performance magic. So this is the magic that where magicians use tricks and deception to create the illusion of the impossible. And that's different to some people who genuinely believe in magical miracles. So the magic that I'm talking about is really the entertainment magic. So to understand magic, I think of magic as really all being about conflict. It's about a cognitive conflict deep inside our brains between the things you believe to be possible and the things that you just experience. So, I mean, you were talking about how you made rabbits appear from hats at bar mitzvahs. That's a beautiful example where consciously and logically you know that rabbits can't simply materialize inside a hat. Yeah, as you're pulling that rabbit out of that hat, that's exactly what you're experiencing. And so magic creates a very interesting cognitive conflict between the things that you're experiencing and the things that you believe to be possible. That's what I think of as magic.
And we need magic in the world. I mean, if nothing was magical, wouldn't life be pretty boring?
I think so. I think, I mean, again, this is one of the interesting questions that we've been starting to look at as well is, well, why are people so drawn towards magic? And I think when we talk about the science of magic, there's a lot of focus on the deception and the illusions and the tricking. There's a lot of positive sides about magic as well, in that magic can elicit wonder, can elicit a whole range of really powerful positive emotions, and it can make the world just a happier place as well.
Oh, I love that. Because, I mean, that's the particular link that you've scientifically been investigating, the link to well-being. How is magic linked to well-being?
So there's lots of programs. A lot of magicians have been using magic as a way of enhancing people's well-being. And we've become very interested in trying to make this link between magic and the enhancement of well-being. And my PhD student, Steve Bagansky, he's dedicated his whole PhD towards understanding this. And I think magic can be used to enhance well-being in different ways. One of the most powerful ways is really through teaching people to perform magic. And we actually do this at Goldsmiths, where we train a lot of our students up in magic. They participate in magic workshops right at the beginning of their course, where they learn a whole range of magic tricks. And we find that this has got a really positive impact on their lives, in that it enhances their self-esteem. So they report that actually learning magic makes them feel better about themselves. And it also enhances their reported well-being as well. So after participating in these workshops, they report they actually feel better about themselves as well.
So learning how to perform magic increases well-being?
Yes, it can. I think it can in certain ways. Now, what we're interested in, and the thing that Steve is particularly investigating...
Now, say who Steve is. Listeners aren't going to know exactly who Steve is.
So Steve Hoganski is one of my PhD students in the Magic Lab, who's really focusing on this well-being aspect of our research.
Great.
But yeah, I think magic has got a lot of really powerful components, because for one, one of the reasons why we're interested in magic is that very few, I mean, you're an exception in that you've got a very deep background in magic as well, but most of our students have never pulled the rabbit out of the hat. So they're all starting at the same point in terms of their expertise in magic. And although it takes thousands of hours of training to become a professional magician, it's actually quite easy for people to learn simple magic tricks. And what we find is that magic is a great tool whereby we can teach someone a skill that previously they thought was just completely impossible. So you watch a magician performing a trick. So for example, he may cut a piece of rope in half and then magically restore that. You watch that, you're very curious about it. You feel, I have no idea how it's done. And our participants generally think that it's impossible for them to be able to do this. And within a relatively short amount of time, we can actually teach them to perform these types of tricks. And performing these tricks in front of other people gives them lots of really positive feedback. And I think that's what makes them feel better about themselves.
And also there's this feeling like a sense of control, right? Like you hear a lot of magicians talk about their early childhood as like being bullied or being the outcast in some way. And doesn't it kind of make you feel like you're doing one up on others?
I think so. I mean, it's an interesting point, really, the whole bullying. Because when you talk to a lot of magicians claim that they got into magic because they were struggling at school or they were the outcast in some ways. And I think magic can give you that special skill that you can do something which others can't do. And I mean, I know I never got bullied at school, but I definitely, being able to perform magic, that opened doors that would have been closed otherwise. And I think that can be a really useful thing, again, in terms of helping people who may not necessarily feel very good about themselves or lack social skills as well, I think.
Yeah.
Because being able to perform magic gives you a script of how you can conduct a social interaction, and it gives something that people can talk about and it makes you interesting as well. So again, I think that's another really interesting aspect of magic.
Yeah, it's just an observation I've made about magicians. Yeah, there's also obviously well-being benefits to experiencing magic, right? Not like being the one doing it, but just being in the audience.
Yeah, so I think there's not that much is known about the impact that experiencing magic, so simply watching magic as a spectator, can have on people's well-being. But there's some research by Eugene Subotsky who showed that watching magical content can increase people's creativity. So these were studies that were carried on children, where children got to see video clips of Harry Potter extracts, and some of these extracts included magic, the others non-magical. And the kids who actually watched the magical content, they scored high on creativity tests.
So how was creativity, like divergent thinking?
Sorry?
Like divergent thinking, like how many uses for
a
brick?
Yeah, different creativity. So I think one of the, so they used a drawing task and an alternative uses task as well, whereby the kids are given a word or a concept and they have to come up with lots of different creative uses for that concept. So those types of tasks.
Well, that's cool, that link to creativity. Why do you think there was that link to creativity?
Personally, I think magic is all about, well, it's about experiencing the impossible, and it pushes the boundaries of what's possible. When you watch someone doing some mind reading, now consciously you think, you know that mind reading isn't actually possible, and yet suddenly you're experiencing something that previously you felt was just completely impossible. And I think that can potentially enhance people's, widen your thinking, and that's what can enhance people's creativity as well.
Whoa, what was that?
That was just a bit of, I think it was just some fireworks in the background.
Where are you right now?
I'm in London and it's just started to get a bit dark.
Okay, sounds like gunshot, but anyway, we'll just overlook that. So, oh, this is great. I'm glad you touched on, you know, creativity is my, like, I get a giddy whenever one of my guests uses the word creativity. You know, there's just research showing that just experiencing, I mean, there is like systematic research showing that weird experiences increase creative thinking. Like they've done experiments where they put you in a virtual reality environment, and if you walk towards a table and it's defying the law of gravity, so things are supposed to get bigger as you get closer to them, but they get smaller. You know, people just completely changing all the things people are used to in their daily life, and you find that they do better on creativity tests. I'll send you some of those papers.
Okay, that'd be great, actually. I mean, that links really with sort of some of the ideas that we have about magic as well, because of course, magic is really all about, yeah, you're entering a world where new things are possible. And I think there's a link to childhood as well. I mean, I'll see it. I've got three young kids and their sense of creativity is just absolutely amazing. And quite often when we talk to people after they're watching some magic tricks, they report that it reminds them of their childhood. And again, I think we haven't done much research on this yet, but I do strongly believe that when you're watching very strong magic, it can elicit emotional experiences that are very similar to childhood experiences. And it can evoke this sensation where you're in a world where really lots of things are possible again. I mean, if I look at my kids when they're playing, their pretend play is so creative. And I mean, I'm so boring compared to them because I have all these strict rules and these barriers about what is possible. And so again, I think it's possible that watching and experiencing magic elicits these kind of emotional experiences that can just break down some of these barriers and make you more creative.
I love that. Anything that'll make us more creative, I'm a big proponent of that. So you mentioned misdirection earlier. I think misdirection is just like one of the biggest things in the magician's toolkit. There's been these elaborate setups and things, like I'll watch like a show and be like, wow, that was just impossible. And then I'll like Google like how that magician do that. And there are all these like forums and threads so you can sometimes actually find out the truth. And some of the things are the most banal, like it's a whole elaborate thing, but it all came down to just the magician at one point was just, I turned my head and looked at, they said like, look at this amazing thing over here. And then they just put the whole elephant there and we didn't see it. But do you see what I'm saying? Like some of it, it seems so elaborate when it just came down to a really simple misdirection.
Yes. I mean, I think, I fully agree in that misdirection is really central to all of magic. I published a paper a few years ago, which tried to conceptualize and categorize all different principles in misdirection. And by doing so, I suddenly realized that in actual fact, all magic is misdirection, in that it's almost impossible to think of any magic trick without misdirection. But I think there's a lot of misconceptions really about what misdirection is as well. When you look up the term misdirection in Wikipedia or any dictionary, it generally simply talks about attention. It talks about distracting someone's attention to prevent them from seeing certain things happen. And attentional misdirection is an important component, but misdirection is far more complex in that it involves cognitive processes across a whole wide range of spectrum. So manipulating what you're attending to is simply one misdirection process, because you can use misdirection to manipulate how and what you remember about an event. And you can also use misdirection to manipulate how you reconstruct an event and actually reason about an event. And so the way that we think of misdirection now is really linking it to our cognitive understanding of the human mind, which looks at the encoding process, so that's the perception of something, the memory of the event, and then your reasoning about the event as well.
So there's a lot more that goes into it.
Yeah, there's a lot. So it's, you can think about misdirection as manipulating what you're seeing. But of course, when you're watching a magic trick and afterwards you try and work out how it's done, mistakes can happen at lots of different levels. So you may not necessarily have seen what's happened. So it can, that can prevent you from actually working out how it's done. Or maybe you saw it, but you simply didn't remember it. So that's where the memory processes can kick in. Or you can actually remember all of the details about the magic trick, but you simply cannot actually work it out. And so that would be the reasoning process that is being misdirected.
Nice. So I'm curious, like, does magic have a neural basis? Like, what if we looked at the brain of the person as they're being misdirected? Like, what would we see? What has your own research shown?
Well, I think everything has got a neural basis. So
I know. As long as you're alive, it was a leaning question.
And as long as you accept that all cognition happens inside our brain.
Well, this is the question you posed in your book.
But I think there's about 10 years ago or more, we started a project that tried to study the neural basis of magic in terms of, and here by magic, I mean watching simple magic tricks. Now, I was lucky to collaborate with a friend of mine, Ben Paris, who was working in a big lab where they had access to neuroimaging, which allowed us to use functional neuroimaging to try and study the brain activation whilst people are watching a magic trick. Now, at the time, this is quite a while ago. Neuroimaging has moved on a lot in the last 10 years, but this was a time where you could still get really excited about just identifying a brain area that would be responsible for a particular task or so. And our dream was at the time to just find this one spot in the brain that would be responding to magic. And we already came up with the name of calling it the magic spot. But this kind of shows you a little bit how naive we were kind of like about this research. And so we created lots of video clips of me performing magic tricks. A lot of this was actually filmed. We didn't have much funding for this. A lot of this was filmed in my bedroom of me performing magic tricks. And we had control conditions as well. So, for example, I would make a coin disappear. But in these kind of studies, you need a control condition as well. So I would use a coin and do something unusual with it. I can't remember what it was. Maybe I would have brushed my teeth with it or shoved it in my ear or something like that. And we then scanned people's brains whilst they were watching these magic tricks and compared the neural activation to when they were watching something that was simply unusual. Now, the results were really very surprising in that we got fairly localized activation that was responsible for the perception of magic tricks, which was in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and then an area known as the ACC.
I love the ACC, conflict resolution.
Exactly. Now, at the time, we were a bit disappointed because we were trying to find a more specific area. But then, of course, it turns out that the ACC is responsible for this conflict resolution, which fits very nicely now with this idea that magic is really all about cognitive conflict between the things that you're experiencing and the things that you believe to be possible. So although we were a bit disappointed at the time, actually now the way that we're thinking about magic, a lot of this neuroimaging works makes a lot more sense.
Oh, for sure. I mean, obviously, there isn't like a magic part of the brain. Like, this is a process that we go through a lot in our daily life, and magic plays off of these deeply evolved brain areas.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point. I mean, magic is unique in that it can create this sense of wonder. But of course, a lot of the cognitive processes that are actually involved in magic happen to us all the time.
I mean, all the time.
Perceptual illusions. We are constantly being fooled by all of these illusions. It's just that during the day-to-day life, you just don't realize that you're being fooled by the illusions. And again, with this cognitive conflict, I mean, maybe there is something unique to magic, or maybe it's really very similar to other kinds of conflict that we are still really at the beginning of trying to discover.
Love it. So do we all experience the same magic?
It's very difficult to really know what someone else is experiencing, but I don't think we do. And there's several reasons. For one, I mean, if we think about, so in terms of magic, like if we now think of magic as being about this conflict relies on two main factors. The first one is what you are perceiving, and the second one is what you believe to be possible. Now, of course, we all have different beliefs about what is possible. think about an extreme example with kids. Now, kids have got very different beliefs about the world. And so things that seem impossible for us may actually seem possible for them. So if you think about the concept, like early on, infants, they don't have the concept of object permanency. And what this means is that for them, objects that go out of sight may also disappear. Now, of course, right. You and I know that if an object is simply occluded by something, so if you've got a cup of coffee on your table and your box of Rice Krispies is occluding your view of your cup of coffee, you know that cup of coffee hasn't disappeared. It's still there, even though you can't see it. Now, this is known as object permanency, and it's a process that doesn't kick in until quite later on in life. And so that's really at this object permanency is at the center of a lot of magic tricks where you make an object disappear and you really surprise and amazed by that. Now, you're amazed by this because you know that objects don't simply disappear in everyday life. A young child won't have that concept. And so for them, simply making an object disappear won't elicit that type of cognitive conflict. And indeed, if we look developmentally, children have a very different experience of magic tricks to adults. But I think even for us adults, we all have different beliefs about the world. And since magic is about creating this conflict between your experience and your belief, you will probably experience a magic trick as very differently to the way I do it. And again, like anecdotally, you know, I've realized this where think about mind reading. I have performed mind reading effects for people who genuinely believe that these things are possible, and they actually experience a mind reading magic trick as being very different to someone who's more skeptical about this. So I think that's on one level. But then with this conflict, it's about the belief and your experience. And again, the more we're learning about how the human brain works, the more we've come to realize that all of our experiences of the world are really very different as well. And so given that we all experience the world differently, that also implies that we should be experiencing magic very differently as well.
Yeah, but I mean, isn't the magician banking on the fact that their audience is not experiencing it differently? I guess you're hoping that your audience is a bunch of newbies.
Well, you do to a certain extent. I mean, I think as a magician, you do try to create this illusion in everyone, but you'll never have, the audience will never respond. Everybody is different, and so everybody will respond differently to a particular effect. Now, in certain circumstances, these differences may be smaller, but in others, they may be bigger as well.
Well, I'm just so interested in different types of magic, and there's a particular type that interests me. These, what are they called? The mind illusionists?
Yep. Mentalism.
Mentalism. So interested in mentalism. I saw a show in Vegas not that long ago that just really did blow my mind. I just can't understand how he... And I talked to the people afterwards, like, were you planted? They're like, no, he literally guessed the obscure name of my ex-girlfriend. And I just don't understand how they do it. Can you tell me how they do it?
I'm currently in enough trouble with the magic circle if I tell you how it...
The magic circle must love you.
I'm currently being investigated by their exposure committee, and there's a good chance that I'm being expelled from the magic circle.
Oh my gosh, that sounds horrible.
Telling people that that magicians misdirect your attention. It's pretty much as silly as that.
Yeah, you have a whole theory about the Bayesian theory of misdirection, and they're like, that's so nerdy, you must be expelled.
I'll have to be expelled for that. But I mean, I try to with a lot of this research. I mean, I love magic, and I don't really want to give away any of the secrets. But in this case, I have no idea how this is done. And I think mentalism is a really fascinating area of magic, and it's probably one of the most popular areas of magic as well. And I think what's really interesting about mentalism is that it blurs this boundary between real magic and trickery. So when you're watching a magician pulling a rabbit out of a hat, most people know it's a trick. Like, you don't think that the magician's got genuine magical powers. you realize that what you are seeing is an elaborate illusion. With mentalism, this is in a slightly different area, because once someone starts reading your mind, we become much more likely to actually accept what you are seeing as being genuine or real. And in particular, when mentalists start using psychological principles as well. So I don't know in the States whether, I mean, like in the UK, Derren Brown is a very popular
magician. I was going to mention him.
I mean, he's one of my favorite magicians.
Do you know him personally? Are you friends with him?
I don't know him personally, but I do really, really like a lot of his delusions. And of course, Derren Brown, he created a new type of magic, which he calls mind control. And so rather than claiming that he's reading people's minds, he claims to be using psychological principles to read someone's thoughts. So he may claim that he's reading your body language or micro expressions, or use elaborate psychological priming to influence your decision making as well. Now, what's interesting about this is that when people watch these types of illusions, they genuinely believe that that's what he's doing, when in actual fact, it often involves simple magic tricks. I mean, I'm saying simple, it's not simple, because they're really very clever magic tricks, but it's a similar kind of magic tricks that other magicians may use when they claim that they're reading your mind. So what Derren Brown is doing is he's giving you a psychological pseudo-explanation as to what he's actually doing. Now, we've done a lot of work research on this to show that people genuinely believe that this stuff is real. Now, what's even more worrying is that it doesn't really matter whether you tell people that they're watching a magician or a psychologist. So even if they tell them, actually, you're watching a magician who's using tricks, people still genuinely believe that the kind of principles that they claim to be doing are actually real. And this is what makes mentalism so interesting, in that it really blurs the distinction between real magic, or what people think of as real magic, and trickery.
And obviously there's individual differences there in how people perceive that. You might have the diehard cynics when you tell them, well, that like changes something in their brain and the way they perceive it.
Yeah. So over the last 5 years or more, we've been carrying out a big research project, not just on these mentalism effects using psychological explanations, but also using spiritualist explanations. So what we're interested here is why people believe in genuine magic and things that normally would be impossible. And so in these experiments, we get a magician to come and perform some magic for our students, and they use this form of mentalism. So we create a fake spiritualist experience whereby the magician may read a person's aura, read personal information about the person, and then do a really specific reading where we get them to find out about their deceased relatives. Now, all of this is done using tricks. I mean, it's very clever tricks and very powerful tricks, but it is tricks. But half the participants were initially told that they're going to be watching a magician, whilst the other half were told that they're watching a genuine psychic. Now, what's very interesting is that this manipulation, so this framing, whether we tell them it's a magician or a psychic, has very little impact on how they interpret what they've just seen. So we have people who we've told, you're watching a magician, he's using tricks, and they still genuinely believe that the person's got real spiritual powers. But what we find is that people's interpretation of what they're seeing is very strongly linked to their prior beliefs, as you suggested before, in that the diehard skeptics, well, they will attribute what they're seeing down to trickery, whilst the believers are more likely to attribute what they've seen to genuine spiritual powers.
Yeah, have you looked at openness to experience as a personality moderator?
We haven't in this context. No, we have in other contexts looking at people's enjoyment for magic. But rather surprisingly, we don't actually find any correlation between openness to experience and people's enjoyment for magic, which is something I would have predicted.
I would have predicted that too.
don't find any correlation between any of the major personality traits.
Well, that's good news for you all. Sorry, what were you going to say?
So, as a researcher, that was very disappointing. But of course, in some ways, it is also very encouraging in that it suggests that actually magic seems to tap into something that's really very rather universal.
Universal. So what is the magician's force?
The magician's force is a principle that magicians use to influence your decision making. So, for example, you may be asked to pick a card. So I might have a deck of playing cards. I'll shuffle the cards and I'll ask you to pick a card. I then say, I'll read your mind. But in actual fact, rather than reading your mind, I forced that card, which means that I knew beforehand which card that you're going to be choosing. And the magician force is a general principle. It's a principle a bit like misdirection, whereby magicians have got lots of different psychological tricks and principles that they can use to manipulate your decision making. But what's important about this is that your decision making is being influenced even though you are not aware of this influence. So you feel that you've made a free choice, yet in actual fact, that choice has been forced.
Oh, wow. So have you been studying that personally?
Yeah, so again, so one of my other PhD students, Alice Paller, she's dedicating a whole PhD towards trying to understand the psychological mechanisms that underlie the psychological wow. forces. And again, as psychologists, we're really interested in this because if we think about it, like free will as a central concept to human,
I was going
to
say you're manipulating free will.
And it's been one of these holy grails of psychology, really, is to find powerful ways of manipulating people's decision making processes. If you think about subliminal perception or other forms of priming, and although these principles work, their effects are generally really very, very limited, which makes it quite difficult for us to actually study these processes in the lab. What we're finding with the magician's force is that we've got these really powerful principles, which are highly reliable, and yet people are completely oblivious to the fact that their choice has been manipulated. And this provides us with great tools to study concepts such as free will and our people's sense of agency.
Yeah, I worry about people who use magic for not good, you know, for evil. I mean, you have a lot of people studying up on like hypnosis and things like that, trying to manipulate people.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a real worry with a lot of these. I mean, it's sort of like, I mean, you mentioned hypnosis. I think the impact that fake news and a lot of these other forms of misdirection, which work on a much bigger scale, have and are being exploited by politicians and other organizations, I think that is quite worrying. And I guess, I mean, this is one of the reasons why we're interested in a lot of this research, is to find ways to protect ourselves from this as well. So we've just started a project, which is funded by the Australian government, which is actually looking at whether we can implement some of these magic techniques into artificial intelligence. So whether we can actually use magic principles to prevent us, from being cheated by bots and other artificial intelligence devices.
Yeah, the artificial intelligence is an interesting one. Once they can get the computational power to really blow our minds, hopefully magicians will never become obsolete. You know, it feels like the presentation part is a big part of it, right? The human charisma part to it.
Yeah, the showmanship within a magic performance is really essential for a lot.
Agreed. I know that you do talk about the link between magic and human-machine interaction in your book.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you wanted to say about that topic while we're on it?
Well, that's an interesting link, and one that probably a lot of people wouldn't have necessarily have thought.
I know.
Of.
I was like, this is so cool.
But of course, again, I've mentioned really right at the beginning, one of the reasons why I'm interested in magic is because I think it relates to so many things that we just take for granted as well. I mean, we've spent quite a lot of time talking about perception and free will, but a lot of our human-computer interaction also relies on very similar illusions as well. So as we are now having this conversation over Skype, I can see all of these different icons. Well, of course, this is all an illusion. I mean, I can see a picture of your face there, but you're not actually really there. Similarly, when you're taking a file and you throw it into your trash can, well, the file hasn't actually been deleted. This is all a very elaborate illusion. And as human-computer interaction designers, well, the challenges that they face are really quite similar to the kind of challenges that a magician face, because in some ways they've got, as a computer programmer, you need to create a code that provides the illusion that you're actually interacting with a real object as well. And indeed, I mean, if we look at technological advances, a lot of these advances have been made possible by creating these powerful illusions. So when you're reading it, you might read a book on your iPad and you just have to swipe to move over to the to turn the next page. Well, these swiping actions create the illusion of you actually turning a physical page. And I think a lot of the principles that magicians have been developing within their magic performance context can be implemented to enhance our human-computer interactions as well.
So interesting. I'm really be interested to see how that develops in the coming years.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that has been moving quite quickly as well, as our graphical interfaces are increasing as well. And so another one of my PhD students, Shringi, she's actually directly looking at how we can implement, for example, forcing principles in a gaming environment to increase the user experiences whilst gaming as well.
Yeah, that's very similar principles at play there. Yeah. So how can we advance the magic endeavor?
Well, this is something that I've spent the last 15 years or more trying to convince scientists really to take magic more seriously, because I think it allows us to study the human mind from a very unique angle, and as such, it provides us with a great tool to study human cognition. We've moved quite far, really. At the beginning, a lot of scientists just saw magic as just a bit of fun, and I think now we're at a point where magic is taught in undergraduate courses, as well as become part of textbooks as well. It's become a fairly established field now. I think in terms of the magicians, I've had a more frosty reception, really, and much more skeptical, which I've been really quite surprised by, in that when I tell magicians about using science to enhance the endeavor, they often come back to me saying, well, you know what, we've been performing these magic, or magicians, not necessarily them personally, but magicians have been performing these magic tricks for centuries, if not millennia, and as such, they've got a massive head start, really, on our psychologists. Now, personally, I mean, I can't disagree with this. And one of my motivations for using magic as a tool to study the mind has been because we can tap into all of this useful acquired knowledge about how the brain works. But whilst magicians are very good at knowing what kind of tricks work, they don't necessarily understand why they work. And I think that's where science can really help us, because as scientists and psychologists, we've got pretty good blueprints now of how the human mind works, and that can potentially allow magicians to create much more powerful illusions. But even I think that using the psychological, or sort of like the scientific method, can be used to enhance magic, because I mean, magic is a weird field in that, unlike most other art forms like music or fine art or dance or drama, there's no magic schools. Magic is something that is learned through these informal structures. And most of the knowledge that magicians have accumulated relies on introspection. It relies on informal introspection about carrying out performance, evaluating that performance just through personal experiences, and then writing these ideas down. And some of these ideas are probably correct, but others aren't. And I think if we really want to advance magic, I think we need to use more objective and more systematic scientific principles to really study whether these principles actually work or not. And I think that's where science can help as well. But at the moment, I think this is a very revolutionary idea, and it'll still take a few years for magicians that's on board. But we've actually started a new research project in our lab, which is directly using science as a way of enhancing magic, and hopefully magicians will take this on board.
Oh, that's so cool. So you can actually influence the field of magic itself, not just magic influencing psychology.
I think that it'd be quite a nice way to give certain things back as well, because most of our research, and I think this is some of the misunderstandings come from as well, most of our work uses magic as a way of understanding the human brain, and we're not trying to enhance magic. And so magicians often look at this research and think, well, this isn't really applying to me. I can't really see how I can directly use this knowledge to improve my magic. And of course, the reason why it doesn't work is because that's not what we intend to do. And so what we're trying to do with the project is really illustrate how science can be used to enhance the magic endeavor.
Yeah, no, I love it, and I wish you all the best with this endeavor. Is there anything else you wanted to mention about the research you're currently working on?
No, I guess the thing to mention is that it's a really fairly new, or it's a fairly new field of study, but I've been amazed how in the last 15 years or so it's expanding so dramatically, and we now have people from all over the world who are using magic as a way of understanding a whole range of psychological processes. And you mentioned the Science of Magic Association at the beginning, so I think anybody who's interested in this, do check out the Science of Magic Association, and we hold regular courses. The next one is going to be in Chicago, which brings together magicians and psychologists. So we've got Elizabeth Loftus and Dan Simons,
Oh, yeah.
who are keynote speakers from the psychology side, and really eminent magicians as well, Mahatma King and Simon Aronson. And these are great conferences. They're very lovely as well. And they really try to bridge this gap between science and magic.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Daniel Simmons. Well, thanks again for being on the Psychology Podcast and talking about this topic that we haven't represented yet on the show.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, please add a rating and review of the Psychology Podcast on iTunes. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the podcast, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.